This is Carl Thomas, and you're listening to the Tomorrow's Leaders podcast.
But I'll be honest and say for the first couple of months, I probably woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning thinking, Brian, what on earth have you done, Whitey?
Brian Bickle is the chief executive of Shaftesbury, the £2.9 billion West End landlord. Over 32 years, he's seen the company grow from £10 million, a rocky start, and a couple of small assets to nearly 15 acres across the heart of London.
But I think within sort of 6 weeks of floating at £1.80, we managed to turn that into a pound or less, so it wasn't the most spectacular start.
When Brian became chief executive in 2011, he saw an opportunity to champion LGBT causes in property.
When I became chief executive, no, people knew I was gay and I was sort of out, but I thought now is an opportunity to be a bit of a role model, perhaps.
He joined the board of Freehold, a real estate LGBT networking group, and worked with organizations to make the industry more inclusive. The response was mixed.
A number of large organizations said, well, either, well, we haven't got any gay people here, you know, despite the fact they may have over 500 staff, there was no gay people here, or their attitude was, well, they're perfectly happy, whoever they are.
In our conversation, Brian reflects on being openly gay in property, how things have improved, and where the industry needs to do more.
Now, we even have people joining Freehold and saying, for goodness sake, don't email me at work. I couldn't let anybody at work. I'm now, I'm gay, even in this day and age, and our colleagues up in Birmingham. So if you go 120 miles up the road from London, it's even worse.
We also cover his thoughts on Brexit, which he emphasizes are his views, not Shaftesbury's. His thoughts on retiring, tweeting, and of course, Love Island.
Can I just say, I think, you know, 20,000 years of human advancement has ended up with something called Love Island. There's no hope for this society, really, if that's all we can worry about. Anyway,
carry on.
Keep listening for more from Brian Bickle. This is Carl Thomas, and you're listening to the Tomorrow's Leaders podcast. And in front of me today is Brian Bickle. Brian, thanks for joining me.
It's an absolute pleasure, Carl.
For those who don't know, Brian, can you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do?
Well, I'm the chief executive of a listed real estate investment trust called Shaftesbury. We basically focus our activities on the West End of London. We've been going for just coming up to 32 years this year. And over that period, we've assembled a portfolio of some 15 acres of the West End of London. Across nearly 600 buildings, and the portfolio is concentrated in the heart of the West End. So we own the whole 13 streets around Carnaby. We own probably 80% of Chinatown. We own pretty much all of Seven Dials, the sort of northern part of Covent Garden. We have some smaller interests around Soho, particularly around Berwick Street. We go up as far as Fitzrovia around Charlotte Street and Goodge Street, and then we go east to the sort of east side of the piazza, sort of around the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. So it's a pretty extensive portfolio that we've been putting together. I always describe it as possibly the world's most expensive jigsaw puzzle, because it has literally been bought sometimes one building at a time, or blocks of buildings. And we just keep going at it patiently, as we have done for the 32 years.
Let's go back 32 years.
Yeah, I just about remember that.
How did you get to Shaftesbury? What brought you to property, and why this industry?
Yeah, well, it's I suppose it's all happenstance, really. So if I start really right at the beginning, so I was born here in London, the East End of London. I was born in Dalston, brought up in Hackney, and went to school in Hackney. I didn't go to university. I left school with A levels, and I sort of probably should out myself now and say I'm actually a chartered accountant. I'm not a surveyor in my terms of my professional background, but I qualified as a chartered accountant with A levels. And I spent another couple of years in the accountancy profession, and then decided that wasn't really going to be my future, because in the big professional firms, you expected to have an aspiration of being at sort of partner level, and it just didn't really turn me on. So at the end of 1982, I decided to leave the accountancy profession, and I got a job working for a company, very well-known company at the time, called GEC Marconi, and they were a massive industrial organisation, particularly in defence contracting and what was then technology and that sort of thing. And the job was out in Chelmsford, and I thought, well, this is really exciting. I'll be working in the really racy world of industry. Well, after about the first week there, I thought, Brian, this is not really for you. You should be back in the West End, where you've been working for the last 6 or 7 years. And within 3 months, I found a job as the group accountant. What was then a quite large property company, fourth largest listed property company. So it was a good sort of entree into property. And I suppose I'd already always had a sort of interest in real estate. And I think if you ask me when I was at school, what I really wanted to do was be an architect for some bizarre reason. But I realised in those days to become an architect, you had to do art A-level at school. And certainly in my school, all the weirdest kids did art A-level. I'm not one of those. I'm maths and economics and history and that sort of thing. So I was always a bit more creative with numbers than I was of art. Within 3 years, stock conversion, we got taken over by P&O, who had a big property arm in those days. And I didn't fancy staying on working with P&O. So one of the families that founded stock conversion back towards the end of the Second World War, the Levy family, who were behind the estate agency, D&J Levy, sort of approached me and said, well, we're thinking of putting £10 million into starting up a private property vehicle. So they said, we need somebody to be basically the bookkeeper and the company secretary for 6 months to get this thing set up. So I thought, well, I'll do this for 6 months and it probably won't go anywhere. It'll be really boring. Well, that'll be 32 years in October, 13th of October, day I remember well. And we've taken that £10 million to a public company with a market cap of just under £3 billion now. Let's say our portfolio is just under £4 billion. So I spent Shaftesbury, I spent the first 25 years as a finance director. And in 2011, when the previous chief executive, who had actually started with me and was at stock conversion as well, Jonathan Lane, decided to step down as chief executive, I threw my hat into the ring for the chief exec's role. And so it was a little bit odd because I had spent 25 years saying to everybody, well, chartered accountants should never run property companies. But, you know, you have to, when the facts change, I changed my mind. And I thought, well, I probably could do this, having been here the whole time. And, you know, I've now spent 35 years in real estate. So I sort of understand the way it works.
You listed in 1987.
87. So we managed to kind of float within a year. Mm. It was much easier to do in those days.
But that wasn't long before a crash happened.
No, it's quite a spectacular crash, really. So the company floated just before the infamous Black Monday when the whole global stock markets crashed. I think it was probably the first time it had crashed in that way since the probably great crash of 1929. So it was a bit of a shock to everybody. And we floated at £1.80 a share, and we'd only actually raised something like £8 million. I mean, it was a piddling amount of money when you look at, you know, the money we talk about today. But I think within sort of 6 weeks of floating at £1.80, we managed to turn that into a pound or less. So it wasn't the most spectacular start. But things recovered gradually, and the only bit of property we owned really at that time of any significance was a part of Chinatown, a block of 26 restaurants we'd actually bought back from P&O, which they didn't really want. There was no sort of development angle for them. The share price recovered. We started being like a mini stock conversion. They had offices around the country, so we bought offices in Glasgow and trading industrial estates and things like that. And then, of course, we did get to the property crash of the early 90s, and all of those things became a problem. But our little block of restaurants in Chinatown were never empty. The rents were being paid. There's still a bit of rental growth. And because the income was so secure, actually the values reflected that as well. So our values came down a little bit, but recovered really quickly because the cash flows never really changed. So in 1993, we decided that we needed to get out of all these peripheral things, and we did it. And we were very honest with our shareholders as well that this strategy we had of, you know, being a bit of a small generalist wasn't really working, and plan B was to really focus on the West End of London. So in 1993, we'd sort of cleared the decks of all our problems, but we were in the not very happy position of having 40 million of bank debt and only 20 million of equity left in the business, which is like just enough cash flow to pay the interest bill and, you know, pay the staff, and that was it really. And we raised 20 million through a rights issue and paid down the bank debt and had 40 million of equity, and that's when we started motoring really. So I suppose you'd say 1993 was our year zero moment. We sort of cleared the decks and started all over again.
Were there any echoes of that in 2008, or were you okay by then?
Well, I mean, the business was much bigger in those days, and our portfolio did then exactly what it did. So throughout that whole time, we had no change in our vacancy rate, which sort of generally runs between 2 and 3%. So everything was fully occupied. Rents were being paid. We still had some rental growth in the portfolio. We didn't lose any tenant of any size. The West End remained busy. Poor old Brits, when it comes to the visitor market, the poor old Brits who found themselves much poorer couldn't afford to have all those nice cheap holidays in Europe because the pound had collapsed. And at the same time, all the overseas people looked at London and the UK as sort of bargain basement to go on holiday. So, you know, there are these sort of stabilisers you get in the West End, which we can't think of any other UK location that would respond in the same way.
Considering you basically own the West End.
Well, there's a lot that we well, don't own. There's enough of it for us.
Enough of it. What do you do personally to relax and enjoy London? I'm assuming you don't just stay in the West End.
Well, you say that, Carl, but actually I live now, having sort of moved up housing scale a bit, I actually live in Marylebone, just off Marylebone High Street. So my journey to work every day involves a sort of 15-minute walk from home to the office. So I'm never that far away from the West End. And I do like spending my time around here. I enjoy it. And, you know, being chief executive, you're a bit sort of front of house, really. So I'm the sort of flag waver for the business. I have to go out and about and do lots of things, which does take up quite a lot of my time during the week and evenings and stuff like that. Sometimes try and avoid the West End because I think I've seen too much of it during the week. And the great thing about London is that these fantastic areas that have sort of sprung up over the last 15, 20 years. As a long-term Londoner, you know, places like the east side of London around Shoreditch, King's Cross, those places, you would never have gone there. There was nothing there once upon a time. And to see the way they're being regenerated now, and the buzz and the atmosphere and the energy there, you know, those are great places to go and explore at the weekend. And that's my other little mantra is that, I know it's hard to say if you've done five tough days in London and long journey in, but be a tourist occasionally and you'll see it differently.
Is that why you're dressed like a tourist right now?
Well, it's very hot today as well, but we do have this philosophy at Shaftesbury. Generally, our atmosphere in the office is very relaxed. So there are only 30 of us there, but generally we've got an interesting, endless stream of interesting potential tenants coming in and out with new ideas, new concepts from a, you know, generally much younger generation. So the last thing they want to do is walk into an office full of people in suits and ties. You know, we've got some sort of empathy with what the West End is, which is, you know, much more relaxed than the city. And so, you know, the starting point of that is we'll just say, don't try and look like somebody in a suit, dressed down. So I'm pretty dressed down today.
For the listeners out there, Brian is wearing a polo shirt and shorts.
Yeah. In fact, last week, it was so hot all last week, we had a little vote in the office and we declared it shorts week. So we're all in shorts all week. So that's the joy of being very small and not very corporate in our sort of mentality.
I suppose it's fair to say that you're known as an advocate for LGBT issues.
Yeah.
And you've been openly gay your entire career?
I wouldn't say my entire career. It was very different in the 70s and 80s and probably even in the early 90s, really, that the people weren't so out and, you know, the atmosphere was very different. You know, homosexuality wasn't decriminalised here till 1967. So actually, technically, my first 13 years was probably, you know, as a potential criminal, you know, if I followed my instincts. You know, you're just being put away, which is unthinkable these days. But the working environment has changed a lot over that time. But you know, real estate has lagged other sectors. And we've got a bigger diversity challenge in real estate. I think everybody appreciates that. And there's quite a big LGBT community here, which has not been recognised, but also in a way that it's very much, as I say, it's always been very male-dominated, in a sense that it's an industry that's not open to people generally. People don't know what it's about. We don't sell ourselves very well. We create the built environment, but, you know, if you say to most people property, they think you're probably some estate agent or some pretty evil wheeler dealer property guy that's out to screw them. So we don't have a great public perception, which I think is a shame, because there's great careers to be had for people here across a range of different disciplines. And we've got to get away from the traditional approach of property. When I've told this story many times. When I first went to work at Stock Conversion in 1983, I said it was a pretty old fuddy-duddy company even by 1983 standards. And I'd been there a couple of days, and the finance director took me to one side and he said, "Mr. Bickle, you have to remember you're in property now, not trade." Now that's a very, he said it slightly tongue-in-cheek, but the property view in those days, well, we're the landowners, we collect the rent, we don't need to know what our tenants get up to, we're not interested. And it's almost like a Downton Abbey view of the world, where the property owners are the ones who live at the top of the house and the tradespeople are the ones below stairs that you never really see. So there's always that sort of barrier. He did it, said it half jokingly, but I mean, that was the way where people viewed property, anything to do with real estate, you know, you're not You're not of the rest of the community. So we've got to break down these barriers now, and a lot of that involves addressing sort of diversity issues generally. And so I became, when I became chief executive, no, people knew I was gay and I was sort of out, but I thought now's an opportunity to be a bit of a role model perhaps. And it came along at the same time as something called Freehold was starting up, and that was set up by two guys, David Mann, who's a partner at TFT, and Salim Fazal, who's a property litigation lawyer at Taylor Wessing. And they sort of met each other in a work context before, but on a Saturday morning in Clapham High Street, they bumped into each other with their respective husbands, partners, and they suddenly realised they were both gay. And they went off for a cup of coffee and thought, well, this is ridiculous that, you know, we've met each other. There's no sense of a gay community or LGBT community within real estate. But there must have been lots of people who don't feel they can sort of network and be themselves. So they set up this group called Freehold, which is the LGBT real estate professionals network. And they asked me to get involved shortly after it started because people knew I was out, and I was, say, the CEO of quite a large company at that stage. So, I've been involved in that. And I think it's important to sort of give something back and lead by example and, create an environment where people can be themselves at work. And actually, because, your particular background or whatever, you shouldn't be discouraged from joining this industry. That's where we're going to find the next generation of creative young talent. And they don't want to work in a fuddy-duddy, backward-looking industry, which is, basically living in the past. It's not going to work, really. So Freehold's grown and grown, and within London, we've got a group of just over 1,000 members now. And we've sort of spawned some other groups. So there's a group started up in Birmingham called Open Land. We're trying to support starting up a group in Manchester. There's a separate group for planners called Planning Out that's sort of come out of Freehold. There's a construction group now called Offsite for people who work more on the construction side of real estate. We've also, a lot of the larger firms are starting to set up internal LGBT networks, so people feel more comfortable. There's obviously support from the top that people should feel able to come out and be themselves, but also that people can network amongst themselves as well.
What was the environment like in property at large 30 years ago?
I suppose you could say it was, in some respects, because there are also a lot of people from real estate were drawn from perhaps a more comfortable section of society, middle-class society. There's a sort of rugby club mentality about the whole thing, so public school rugby club. And, I've been to MIPIM many times over the years, and I've always enjoyed myself. But, that's like a rugby club on tour. And it's got to the stage where a lot of women just don't feel comfortable being there. It's so male-dominated. But it's just the way it was. So if you didn't fit the mould, you were not going to be, one of the gang.
Did you ever feel like you didn't quite belong in that gang?
I think there are times, and a lot of people now, we even have people joining Freehold and saying, for goodness sake, don't email me at work. I couldn't let anybody at work. I'm gay, even in this day and age. And our colleagues up in Birmingham, so if you go 120 miles up the road from London, it's even worse. People feel even less comfortable about being themselves. But you almost create a sort of false life for yourself that, you don't talk about what you do at the weekend, you don't talk about your partner. You're trying to live a double life, really, and that's not great for anybody. You don't get the best out of people that way, and it doesn't really create the best environment. Well, I would say once you've told somebody, you go, it's not your problem anymore. Not everybody in this life's going to love you and want to be your best friend, but if they're not happy with the way you are, well, it's their problem. It's, you've got nothing to be ashamed of. It's just the way life is. We've done a lot of work with the RICS, REBA, and the Royal Town Planning Institute to raise the profile of their LGBT members, because quite frankly, when we started out, they weren't interested. In fact, a number of large organisations said, we haven't got any gay people here, despite the fact they may have over 500 staff, there was no gay people here. Or their attitude was, they're perfectly happy, whoever they are. So life's moving on, but it is part of the sort of focus now, acknowledgement that diversity is an issue in this sector. In a way, they're all different strands of the same problem, really. Younger people, don't expect to work in that sort of world these days. They'll do their research, they know where they want to be. And we want those sort of young creatives to think seriously about this industry, because we've got our challenges with the way technology is changing, how we look at buildings and how we use them. We had a discussion the other day as to whether we should just, as a sort of intern basis, have a couple of really challenging teenagers there, because we think we know what we're doing and what what we're providing and how they're using social media. But actually, you know, we're not as keyed into that as we used to be, maybe through all our advisors. We have lots of outsourced advisors. But, you know, it's interesting to hear a very different view from a new generation today. I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose it's always a little tricky to know what you don't know.
Exactly. That's the problem, really. We know what we know, but somebody else said that once, wasn't that Donald Rumsfeld? I don't know what I don't know, which is quite true, really. And a world that is not the world that most of us grew up in, and the way technology has sort of taken over our lives, probably just over the last 15 years. I mean, there's another one of my little stories I'll tell is back in the sort of early 90s when, you know, we weren't so technology obsessed in the office. And I think we probably had a few PCs and a couple of printers. I'm not sure they even sort of networked together, but it was pretty basic stuff. An email came along where people started talking about email. And my colleagues never forget, I said, well, we'll never need email. People will send faxes. Why would people send emails? We won't know whether you're there. You'll never know whether you've had them or not. So I saw doggedly as finance director resisted getting email for about a whole 12 months. I finally gave in. And we did get email, and I just thought, well, it's the future of faxes. Well, who knows what a fax is these days? Mm-hmm. So they remind me of that all the time. I sort of whinge about the money we spend on IT.
What do you think the next thing is that's going to be your email story? Well, what tech are you resisting right now?
I suppose I avoid sort of things like Twitter and Facebook. I don't really get involved with them. I post some stuff on LinkedIn these days. I'm just about sort of handle that. But I don't stand in the way of other things. I understand we have to know about these things, understand about these things, understand how they affect our tenants. I mean, you know, we've got over 300 shops in the West End, and, you know, everybody's aware of the sort of structural challenges around retail, and it's how we need to help out to understand what our tenants are thinking about and how we can help out with all of this. So we do have social media platforms across the business. So we have Facebook pages and Twitter pages. For Chinatown, we have a presence on Weibo and WeChat across China. So we have a Chinese digital agency here in London producing material for that, because we're very keen that visitors coming over from China, and particularly young Chinese students, or for those in London, are aware of what London Chinatown has to offer. So we have to embrace these things. But so I accept that I'm a bit of a dinosaur. I don't have a problem with that. But I understand for a business, we've got to embrace whatever I think about it. You know, I might just say that, you know, if we didn't have the tyranny of emails and technology, our lives might be a little bit calmer. But we are where we are. It's not going to go away. So the business has to embrace it. You know,
Does that mean you haven't embraced emojis yet?
Oh, I get those little things, yes. Yes, I do try and... I must have been a bit old-fashioned. I always try and type my emails properly, and somebody said, well, don't send me a little smiley face. Say, are you happy or something? I can do the basics, really, the absolute basics. But I try not to get drawn into it. I just think, fine, you spend so much time there, and it's not... You can communicate in other ways, like having a conversation as we are at the moment.
That's true. Yeah. We could have the whole thing in emojis back and forth, but... Wouldn't be as
well,
much
it's like
fun.
An alphabet, really, isn't it? You write letters to each other, back to that, really. It's just another form of communication, easy form of communication.
Mm. You mentioned that people didn't want to know what you would get up to on your weekends. Mm. What do you get up to on your weekends? What do you do when you're not in Shaftesbury mode?
I enjoy trying to say, when we're in London, I enjoy being around London and trying to do some of the things. But there's so much to do here, you never quite sort of catch up with it all. We've got the flat down in Brighton, which is a bit of an escape route every couple of weeks. So you do need to just clear your head and get away from this. It's like downside of living so close to the offices. You know, I can wander down to Soho on a Saturday night or Sunday or something. You know, you walk past the office door and somehow your brain clicks into thinking about work mode. There's no physical distance. Mm-hmm. So it's good to just get away and drive out of London. We've got a nice flat down there on the seafront.
Would you rather go to the beach or the forest?
I'm definitely a beach person, so holidays are generally... I've never generally been able to get myself to go on holiday to somewhere that's colder than the place I start off from, so I generally head south, Spain or Italy, very beach-focused. I'm quite happy to chill out doing nothing. I find I've spent my whole life rushing around doing something here. It's slightly I mean, it's not New York, but it's kind of sort of frenetic sort of city here and you're living in it all the time. So I'm more than happy to go and plonk myself down on a beach to get a book or have my iPod and just switch off really and let time drift by, contemplating dinner in the evening. You know, probably the late night clubbing is or something of the past now, but a good meal and a good bottle
doesn't
of wine.
Have to be.
No, it doesn't have to be. You have to be realistic. The sort of recovery time is so bad. You think, oh, that was great. I was just written off a day of my holiday trying to recover from staying out till 4 a.m. So you don't do too much of that, really. You have to be realistic. You don't bounce back like you used to at my age.
If you were on a desert island, you were dropped off on a plane, and you were given one backpack, and that backpack had a DVD player with one movie, two books, one to keep you entertained, one to keep your mind active, and a Walkman with one CD. What would those things be?
Oh, now there's a challenge, really. So my one film, what's the film I like watching most?
It's a Cabaret. It's a Cabaret.
Is it Cabaret? Yes, that was one of my top two, really. Depends what mood I was in, I suppose. I thought I enjoy a good musical, and Cabaret has got lots going on in it, even though it's not very true to the book, as it turns out, but it's a great movie. One of those films I never tire of watching. A bit like Sound of Music, really. That's a bit sort of corny, really, but that would keep you occupied for 3.5 hours, and you generally feel quite good about yourself at the end of watching it.
The ending is a little depressing. The ending is a little depressing.
What in?
The Sound of Music.
Well, they did escape over the mountains.
They did,
yes.
I suppose so.
But it was a sort of four. Yes. It is. There's an undertone there, but it's sort of, you know, it's a bit sort of saccharine-y, really, that they sort of had to get out. So, yeah, those are my film choices, somewhat limited. What was my next one?
Books.
Books. I suppose my favourite book trilogy was always Tales of the City, the Armistead Maupin series. So I could dip in and out of any of those, sort of San Francisco in the 70s, which was sort of growing up time and a coming out time. They were always good value, really. I tend not to read sort of terribly serious sort of technical books and stuff like that. It's never in my library. So I'd have to park that one. So could I have two volumes of Tales of the City? You know, I'll be more serious about one than the other.
I'm sure they'll let you have three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a big ask, really, is it?
And one CD or a mixtape.
I don't know. I think...
Are you a big music fan?
Well, only sort of trashy mainstream music, I suppose. Which I have to say, what I do enjoy is... sort of going back to sort of 70s, 80s, 90s music, which was the era I sort of grew up in, and they were always associated with very good times, and there was a lot of good music produced in those days, and I had some compilation tape of those years. I think it's always great fun. I always think I said to my other half, you know, if something awful goes wrong and I end up in a home and I'm not quite sure where I am and I've got some Alzheimer's problem, I'd just be happy if you play me endless 70s, 80s, 90s sort of hits, really, because it just takes you back to where you were in those days, and it just makes you feel good, and that's probably all I would ask for. And so if I was on my own, you see, I'd be there listening to all those songs, and hopefully I'd on the island, hopefully be able to remember where I was and what I was doing around that era and where you were in that time of your life, because, you know, your life does change an awful lot as you get older. You think you'd be realistic at 64. I've given it away now. You know, you're not the person you were at 32, and you look back sometimes in horror at the sort of what you used to get up to and things. Well, it was fine at the time, but life's moved on. I think music is a great trigger for all those things.
Going back to Shaftesbury, what do you see in the future for yourself and the company?
Yeah. Well, I think Shaftesbury is a listed company. We've set out our stall quite clearly to shareholders what we do, and I think it's important for a business, for management, to be realistic and not think just because we do this one thing in the West End really well, we could go and replicate it somewhere else, because I don't think we could. And I actually always say to shareholders, if you see us going off doing something else somewhere else, I suggest you sell your shares, because I'll have sold mine before you sell yours. So that's the challenge, really. We're not developers. We can't knock our portfolio down. Everything is in a conservation area. 20% of our buildings are listed, so you can't touch them at all. Retail for us has always been slightly different. We had a lot of relatively smaller shops. You know, people talk about, well, leases getting shorter. We've always had 3 to 5 year leases in our shops. You know, life's moving so quickly. Why would you want to think somebody's going to be there for 25 years? Are they really going to be doing what you want them to be doing 5, 10 years' time? You just don't know. So there's got to be flexibility on both sides. So I say the challenge is really to stick to what we do, but make sure we can adapt the model.
And personally?
Well, I should be around for a few more years, yeah. I'm not about to throw in the towel. Obviously, as a business, you know, we've got to make sure we've got plans for succession within the team. That's really important. That's a, you know, that's my prime job, is to make sure that, you know, there's got to be sort of seamless transition in management over time. And because we have a very long-term strategy and a particular strategy, and we've always had a very stable team, we're sort of building in that sort of continuity. So, yes, I'll be around for a few more years because I still enjoy what I'm doing. I look back now. I did my 25 years as finance director, and I did think long and hard about throwing my hat in the ring to be chief executive. And, you know, I'd had some quite stiff competition to get the job, mostly from all those surveyors who I said should be running Shaftesbury and not me. But anyway, I took the job on, and it sort of gave me a new lease of life, because it sounds odd to say, but I didn't quite understand, even though I worked alongside the chief exec for a long time, what it's like to be the man in that seat, or sorry, the person in that seat. You are sort of responsible for the people there and the business, and I wouldn't say it's a lonely job, but it's a responsible job. But it gave me something different to do, and quite frankly, I was getting fed up with accounting standards and regulation that goes with anything financial these days.
What were some of those surprises that you had when you became chief executive?
I don't know, I suddenly felt, you suddenly have this sort of ultimate responsibility. Being number two, as finance director is always sort of number two, you're not quite in the firing line, really. I mean, if something happened, you'd have to step up in the short term. But I'll be honest and say, for the first couple of months, I probably woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning thinking, Brian, what on earth have you done? Why didn't you stay with your head slightly below the parapet as finance director? Actually, I sort of got through that, and it was okay, really. I've settled into it. So I rarely wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning worrying about things. Now, it does help. I've got a great team of people around me. They're all very supportive. You know, that's what you need as chief executive. We're all long-term committed to the business, and that helps, really.
Was there any point during those 25 years and now, 32 now, where you thought, maybe I'll try something else now?
No, I suppose I must be a sort of innate chartered accountant, really. I just stick to the safe, tried and trusted, really. So I know the good thing about accountancy is it's finance and accounting is a sort of transferable skill. You can go off and do it, other things, and lots of people do move around industries. And I've sort of ended up, as I said, bearing in mind, it's only recently occurred to me, I suddenly remembered I did used to have this hankering for architecture and buildings. I've probably ended up in the best place, really, through a complete set of accidents of history. But here I am, and I've enjoyed it. So, yeah, how lucky am I?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people in similar positions to you have sort of similar stories where they had no idea how they eventually ended up there. It just kind of happened.
Life is scarily uncertain, really, and it's odd things that happen to you, people you meet, sometimes things that go wrong. In a way, my career choice when I came out of the profession was a bad one, but I was able to say, to my credit, I could have sat there for a couple of years and wasted my time and picked up my salary, but I knew it wasn't right. I did something about it. And not every decision you will make in this life is right. You know, I've made some bad ones at work, and you know, but you just have to fess up to it. You know, we always say, you know, people make mistakes at work, and I thought, well, the worst thing to do is just try and bury them. We all make mistakes, you know, just try not to make the same mistake again. But that's how we learn, really, by the things that go wrong are just as important as the things that always go swimmingly, and it's that's part of the learning process. We have a little joke in the office. We choose our tenants very carefully, and everybody in the office says, well, if Brian and the finance director like that particular concept, we're not having it because we don't want anything that accountants would like, really. That's not quite as creative as we were hoping for. But as I say, we do take an awful lot of trouble about who we put into the restaurants, and we're just conscious that we've got to keep pushing the envelope, and there we might make some mistakes. We always say if we don't have a few failures, we've been a bit too safe, but, you know, not too many failures.
How do you make those decisions?
Get involved. We've got a good property team of experienced people. Shaftesbury works with 30 staff, but we outsource all the day-to-day running of the business to managing agents and project managers and all sorts of professionals that help make it work. So if you want to take a shop or a restaurant from Shaftesbury, you get a bit of a Dragon's Den-style interview about, you know, what are you doing, what do you plan to do, you know, what's your target market, do we think you're right for the area. The bizarre thing is that offering us the highest rent, won't get you into a property if you're not, if you've got a concept we fundamentally don't like or don't think would be right. But say we are absolutely focused on choosing people, and you know, we'd rather keep something empty than have the wrong person in there.
One thing I wanted to do was play a quick round of word association.
Oh dear. Yeah, this is just quite challenging. It's not going to be a psychometric test, is it? I'd probably fail miserably.
Do a Rorschach test as well.
No, please. I'm told that sort of thing.
Okay. First word, London.
Dynamic.
Retail.
Evolving.
Love Island.
Avoid. Can I just say, I think, you know, 20,000 years of human advancement has ended up with something called Love Island. There's no hope for this society, really, if that's all we can worry about. Anyway, please carry on.
Have you ever watched the full episode of Love Island?
No, I've dipped in and out of it. It's a bit like Made in Chelsea and all those other things that I just think, well, you know, it's fine, it's entertaining, but you know, I don't quite
spending 6 weeks watching it.
Well, I'm a bit worried about some of my colleagues. It seems to be the main topic of conversation every morning in the office. I just keep my distance. They don't even get me involved anymore because they know what I'm going to say.
Twitter.
Not for me. That's three words, I know. That's avoid, probably.
Another avoid.
Yeah, well, I think I'm sort of turning into a bit of a grumpy old man if I let rip on Twitter about some of the things that go on. You know, I wouldn't be quite as bad as a certain president of a certain large country, but, you know, it's something you get drawn into, and you know, it's not best avoided.
So you're not tempted to set up a Twitter account under a fake name and...
No.
Rail against everything.
No. We don't get me onto my Brexit views. I could be some sort of Brexit ranter, if you like, but I'm not going to do that.
No. What do you make of Brexit in terms of what, where London and the West End will sit?
My view about London is, I think London, setting aside what I think about Brexit, London will still be the largest city in Western Europe, and it is still a global city in the way that not many cities are. You know, it has a size and a history and a dynamism, which means it's always survived, really. It's had its ups and downs. It hasn't always been brilliant. It was sort of struggling a bit in the 70s and sort of picked itself up in the 80s and 90s. So what we have today shouldn't be taken for granted, but it, as long as we embrace what's going on in the rest of the world, and you know, we don't try and put a wall around the UK or London, and we're open
there's
to ideas.
There's already a sea around it.
Well, there is, really. No, there's a sea around everybody else. You know, you've got this the wrong way round, Carl. You know, we're not on the island. Europe's on the island. It's not us at all. They're leaving us. Haven't you realised that? But no, as long as London's open and dynamic, and it, you say we have lots of natural advantages here in our language and culture and history, and there's that sort of becomes a melting pot for different ideas, that sort of generates its sort of dynamism, really. I think London will probably be okay. We shall see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got, as I said before, I do have my European passport in case everything... Mm.
Everything goes horribly wrong, really. Well, we'll wait and see, really. But I you know, without being too political, I just think that we have lots of problems in our society here, and we've made some decisions over perhaps my generation that have been rather short-sighted, and we haven't thought about our future properly. And it has created a lot of division and discontent in society here. And leaving, we blame Europe. These are all things we've done to ourselves. These are problems we've sort of let happen. Europe didn't interfere in a lot of these decisions. And leaving Europe is not the answer to them. If we end up making ourselves poor, it's going to exacerbate the situation. But, we, you know, from the day we leave, none of our problems are going to change. You know, this is the things we've got to face up to. And sadly, politicians generally are not interested in having those sort of more fundamental discussions about where we as society need to go and address some of these issues. If we feel so divided and so split in the way we do, you know, somehow we've got to bring all this back together again. But just leaving Europe is not going to solve anything. In fact, it's a total diversion. Problems will only be there on the 30th of March.
It's not very long.
No, it's not. Really, it's not. And we don't seem to have a plan yet, but perhaps there is one and we don't know about it.
Hopefully.
Anyway, that's straying into the politics. And, you know, that's my personal view. Shaftesbury doesn't have a view about these things.
Exactly. Yeah. Politics aside, let's leave the listeners, because I believe we've been here for ages now. We have been here for ages.
It's just flown past. I can't believe.
I'm not sure how all this time has passed already, but listeners will, of course, want to hear some words of wisdom from someone who's been in the industry for over three decades now. What's one piece of advice you would give someone going into property right now?
I think it's a great choice to come into the world of real estate. I think you'll meet some great people. But it's an industry that is changing fast, I think, because it's having to respond very quickly. So don't think of it as something staid and backward looking. You've got an opportunity to come in now and shape its future in so many different levels and bring sort of skill sets and knowledge and experience that, you know, probably have been absent from the sector for far too long. So I think it's a great time to be joining, and you will not regret a career in I call it the built environment. That's what we do. We create the built environment that everybody has to live in. And if you're part of that community that we're trying to address, you bring fantastic benefits to how this industry shapes up over the next generation. So go for it. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Brian. It's been great.
Thank you, Carl.
Great.
Is that all right?
Yeah, as long as I recorded.
Well, I can't do it again. That wasn't a script, you know.
Oh, yeah.